that everyone refuses to introduce matrix product states in this talk. So only Glenn introduced Mera. But I'll give a brief introduction into those states in a moment. So let me just briefly introduce a context of the talk. So this talk is in the context of tensor network states, so like matrix product states, Mera, et cetera. And these kind of states provide some way to efficiently describe correlated many-body states from some local perspective. So there's a local object, a local tensor, which kind of describes a state based from some local entanglement. So starting from a local entanglement structure, you get a description of a state which can have very complicated entanglement. So for instance, topological states like the Torrey code are actually in that class. So despite this local description, this class can describe quite intricate entanglement. And well, these tensor networks are both good for numerical simulations, as we've seen in some talks this morning. But they also form a powerful analytical ansatz. One can use them to construct, in some sense, solvable models where one can exactly compute quantities. So in this talk, I want to use PEPS to identify topological systems which have a spin-liquid nature. So there are basically two parts kind of relating to the topological part and the spin-liquid part, and the results could be also applicable separately. I will try to apply them simultaneously to characterize resonating valence bond states in particular. So we've heard more about topological spin liquids this morning. So the idea of a spin liquid, in my kind of naive understanding, is that what we have is a system with a kind of high degree of symmetry, in particular rotational symmetry, antiferromagnet or something like that, which however does not break any symmetry. There's no local order parameter. But if it's a topological spin liquid, there should be a topological ground space structure. So it's kind of the third case in the 2D Liebschultz-Mattis theorem, which says that there could be a local order parameter, a gapless system, or there could be topological order. That's a topologically ordered case. Two invariants. And it's kind of difficult to characterize these systems in some sense because you have to identify the topological order, which cannot be identified locally. And you have to identify, if you want to show it's a spin liquid, the absence of any kind of long-range order, which is also difficult because, of course, you can check for specific order parameters, but to kind of rule out any kind of order parameter seems much more difficult. And so in this talk, I would like to apply PEPS to characterize the spin liquid nature of resonating valence bond states as an example. But the ideas apply beyond that. So the concept I will present apply to general translation invariant PEPS with certain properties. So one could actually also apply this to other ansatz states or to tensors also obtained from numerical simulations with infinite PEPS, like the ones Philippe will mention in his talk, possibly. Okay, so I will focus on the Kagome lattice in my talk, which is, I guess, interesting because it's realized in nature in the Heisenberg model, with the Heisenberg model in Herbert-Smithite. But it has also this high degree of frustration, which makes it a likely candidate for not breaking symmetries. So the basic idea for resonating valence bond states is, so first we start with this Kagome lattice and we define what is a dimer covering, which is we kind of place these blue dimers on edges of the lattice so they connect to adjacent vertices. And we look at complete coverings of this lattice of such with such dimers. And well, now, of course, we want some representation in a Hilbert space. So each dimer configuration should be associated to some vector in a Hilbert space. And the kind of natural way which gives resonating valence bond states is to say each of the vertices has a spin 1/2 associated with it. And whenever we have one of these blue dimers, what we do is we put a singlet on that link. So each of these dimer coverings is represented by a tensor product of singlets. And the resonating valence bond state, the nearest neighbor resonating valence bond state, is then given as a uniform superposition of all such possible coverings, so they kind of resonate with each other. So the REB is kind of a good ansatz for antiferromagnets, because while the singlets minimize the energy locally of an antiferromagnetic interaction, but by making them resonate, one can actually also decrease the overall energy, because kind of, you know, the Heisenberg Hamiltonian favors flipping sides with a minus sign. And so the question I would like to look at is the RVB state a topological spin liquid, which requires several things. Well, if we want to talk about the topological spin liquid, somehow we need a Hamiltonian. So in the first place, we need to identify if this state does actually appear as a ground state of some local Hamiltonian. Once we have such a Hamiltonian, we need to identify if that Hamiltonian has a topological ground space structure. And then finally, we need to identify that there's no long range order in that system. So these are the questions I will address. Is the RVB a ground state of a local Hamiltonian? Does this Hamiltonian have a topological ground space structure? Then I would like to see how it relates to known topological models. Can we actually see that it's in the same phase as the toric code? And then, is there a long-range order in this state, or is it a liquid? Okay, so what people typically have studied so the problem with RVB is that, well, one of the problems is that different singlet configurations are not orthogonal. They have a finite overlap. So it's kind of difficult to identify a singlet configuration with a Hamiltonian somehow. So it's difficult to kind of figure out what Hamiltonian should have the RVB as a ground state. So what people typically are often looked at is a simplified version, which is kind of an orthogonal dimer model, where in some more or less abstract or concrete sense, we just say that each different dimer configuration should be identified with an orthogonal vector in Hilbert space. You can do this locally by marking where there is a dimer or in an abstract way by looking at the picture. I mean, there are many ways to do it. And the idea is that once these guys are orthogonal, you can write down a Hamiltonian, which kind of is very similar to the toric code Hamiltonian. There's actually a map into the toric code. with two kind of terms. One ensures that on each triangle, there are only valid dimer configurations. So there's either one dimer on the triangle or no dimer, only outgoing dimers. It's like a vertex constraint in the toric code. And the other one is kind of a resonance move, which along hexagons will take two configurations and transform them. Like for instance, here we could transform this configuration into the red one along the loop or back. So we could have some resonance moves. And it turns out that basically all of these singlet configurations, sorry, these dimer configurations, can be transformed into each other by such local resonance moves, except for a topological invariant. And the idea is that if we look at such moves, we make any cut through our system, we see that such a move will, in this case, not change the number of singlets. There are actually moves which can change the number of singlets, but because it's kind of shifting things along a closed loop, we can only change the number of dimers crossing a line modulo 2. So there's a Z2 conserved quantity which cannot be changed by these local moves. That's like the number of loops in the toric code which you cut. So this way we see that this dimer model, I mean, this is all known and has been done a while ago. This dimer model can actually be mapped to the toric code. It's a Z2 topological, if you wish, spin liquid, but of course it doesn't have a natural SU2 symmetry or anything like that. Okay. Okay, so I want to return in like two slides or so back to the resonating valence bond states built of singlets. But first I would like to introduce a tool which are projected entangled pair states. So the idea is that we start from a grid of entangled states. The most common thing is to use just simple bipartite maximally entangled states, but we could use different states in principle. It's kind of just relevant that they should be kind of have a local structure. And then the second step, we group these guys and apply some linear map. So we have this auxiliary virtual entangled state, which by a linear map, which say projects out some degrees of freedom, we map to actually a physical system, which we then want to describe that way. And there's an alternative notation, which I will not use in the first part of my talk, only in the second one when I talk about some numerical results, which is that this can be written as a network of tensors. So each of these linear maps can be associated with a 5-index tensor because it acts on 4 auxiliary systems, which it maps to 1 physical system. And if we adopt this graphical notation that connecting legs means identifying the index and summing over it, such a network, if we continue it, say on a torus, will just have open indices pointing up, which are the physical indices. So that's just the expansion coefficient in the local basis of such a state. Yeah?
Can you go in the reverse, starting with the ring tensor? Can you write
it? It's equivalent, the two pictures, yes. So the idea is that this maximally entangled state is basically just a delta function, if you look at it, right? It's kind of a Kronecker delta. If you apply a linear map with this bra index here, this guy will just induce a delta between the coefficients of the bra of one map and the other map and put a sum in front, right? So summing over an index is just equivalent to taking these two guys and connecting them by this kind of entangled state. If it's a different entangled state, there are ways around. So it turns out that many states, like the toric code, or as I will show you in like two slides, the RVB state have an exact description of that kind. But on the other hand, these states are actually also very useful in numerical simulations. But that's not topic of this talk. So there's an important point to note, which is there are actually many flexibilities in the description. We could choose different entangled states. But an important one is that we could block sides. And instead of taking 2p's, we can just decide we block a couple of sides. We have a new map mapping on a bigger physical system, active on more auxiliary entanglement, which kind of can change the description, but it describes the same state. And if we block a finite number of sites, it's still a local description. And okay, so in the next slide, I would like to address how can we relate these guys to Hamiltonians? Can these guys appear as ground states of local Hamiltonians? And under which condition do we know that it's unique or topologically degenerate or something like that? So first, I would like to explain when these kind of states can be unique ground sets of local Hamiltonians, because it's kind of the topological case is just a generalization of that. So the idea is that we look at this map and we impose the following condition: that this map is injective. So meaning that different auxiliary states are mapped to different physical states. Now, this might seem very artificial, because in many cases, this P is kind of might be a projection or something like that. So it actually does not do that job. But remember, I told you we can block this guy. And blocking has the effect that the number of green indices, auxiliary indices, scales like the boundary of the blocked region, whereas the number of physical indices scales like the volume. So at some point, just by parameter counting, we should actually expect this map to be invertible, to map different auxiliary things at the boundary to different physical things. So let's imagine this happens. It does indeed happen for many models, for typical models. So what does this mean? It means there's a left inverse. It means mathematically, at least, we can apply a map which allows us to access this auxiliary entanglement. So there is this invertible map acting on all these guys, which leaves us just with a tensor product of entangled states. No map applied, right? Essentially just a product state. And by applying this map P again, we can go back. So we can go back and forth between this state and this very, very simple state, which is, of course, a ground set of a local Hamiltonian. We just need to take projectors between nearest neighbors onto these entangled states. So one minus a projector onto that state will have that state as a ground state, and everything else will be an excited state. So we can write this very simple state projecting onto these entangled states omega. This will be a positive operator, positive Hamiltonian. It will annihilate that state. So it's a ground state, and it's indeed a unique ground state. And the thing is that now we can take this Hamiltonian and kind of dress it with this map. And the effect is that, is this written somewhere nicely? Not really. The effect is that if we hit this guy here with this new Hamiltonian, this P inverse will annihilate the P where the Hamiltonian acts. So the Hamiltonian just acts again on the entangled state and it annihilates it, and it's still a positive operator. So it will again be a ground state. And if you're a bit careful about restricting your physical system, you can go back and forth, or you can indeed see this must again be a unique ground state. Because if there would be a second ground state for this guy, this would induce a second ground state here. So this property that the auxiliary entanglement can be fully accessed, that these maps are injective, allows us to show that these states are unique ground states of local Hamiltonians. Now, this will not happen for the RVB state, at least if this argument I gave you for the dimer state is correct. So what's different there? Okay, so now let me first explain how to write the RVB state as such a PEP state, and then we will very quickly see what is a property which makes it impossible to get this injectivity of this map. So what is the idea? Well, if we want to write this in a local description, one can look at these triangles, and well, in the state, there are two types of triangles. There are triangles with one singlet and triangles with no singlet. So we encode this by putting in each triangle some entangled state, which is now tripartite, but remember I said, there are flexibilities in the description. We can indeed transform these descriptions. And the state on the triangle just encodes the fact that there can be a singlet on a pair of sides, or that there's no singlet. And we do this by introducing a third level, which is kind of the vacuum, if you wish, right? So either we put a singlet or we put a tag, which tells us there's no singlet at that side. And we do this in all combinations. And well, so this means that this thing places a singlet or no singlet to each triangle. In the second step, we apply a map which selects either the singlet subspace from the left, these two guys, and the no singlet subspace from the right, or vice versa. So we just select the singlet from one of the two sides. And this will indeed leave us with exactly one singlet per side, because remember, the singlet corresponds to actually having a singlet, right? If there was no singlet, there was this extra level. But we insist that we pick one of the singlets at each side. So this provides such a description for the RVB state. We can also describe the dimer state by just being kind of keeping more information. This map is very similar to this map. It again picks either the singlet from the left or the singlet from the right, but it kind of keeps the information where it picked it from. So if you know about the arrow representation of the dimer state, it kind of also keeps an arrow pointing from which triangle the singlet came.
So are you changing the physical space here?
Well, it's the green space is not physical, right? Oh, you mean between here and here?
Yeah. Again, what's the difference between the two?
I think the good way to think of that would be to tensor, to do a unitary transformation on this space, which isolates, first of all, this guy, and second of all, a second level, which is entangled with it.
So this is projecting into some physical degrees of freedom, is that correct?
Yes.
So
well, of course you're only using a four-dimensional subspace here. Right? It's up to relabeling, that's a four-dimensional space.
How many sites do you have? That's for a single site.
That's for a single site, but I'm interested in this state really. This is just to show that this dimer state, which can be kind of treated quite abstractly, right? You just want orthogonal dimer configurations. It's not so relevant how you make them orthogonal. It's nice if it's in some sense local. But kind of the right way to look at it would be to say that, you know, you take this guy, which is zero and plus, and this guy, and you map it to zero minus, and the same for one, which means this is indeed the degree of freedom you were actually looking at here as well.
What's your representation of the zero? What's each piece of what you wrote there?
Oh, that's kind of saying I could do a basis transformation to this basis.
Wait, but what's like the 0, 2? What's the zero? Which degrees?
Oh, what? 2, 0? Sorry?
Are we working on a bond here?
It's the physical level.
Well, it's a bond, but we're applying a projection to a subspace, but we keep all the information except for the projection. Whereas if we actually want the RVB, we discard the information where we took the signet from. But we could also keep it.
So that's the difference between having orthogonal dimers.
Exactly. Well, that's one way to get some orthogonal. So indeed, the point is that we can basically continuously discard this information. Right? We can do some kind of filtering, so we can continuously throw away part of it and make these things less and less orthogonal. And at some point, when we completely discard the information, we get to the dimer state. So we can find a way to locally, smoothly interpolate this map P between the dimer model, which we understand, which is like a toric code model, and this RVB model, which is not well understood, or not so well understood. OK, so now the key point about these tensors for building this thing is that they have a symmetry. So consider a Z2 symmetry with, well, a representation with identity and Z, where Z flips the sign of this 2 level. So remember, this was a level encoding the singlet, and this was a level encoding no singlet. And you can see, if you look at triangles, for instance, there's always an odd number of outgoing singlets. It's just kind of a simple counting argument. And this is indeed reflected in the symmetry. So this object here is antisymmetric under the symmetry, for instance. And this object is also antisymmetric under the symmetry, because there's exactly 1, 2 here on the right. So I'm only acting on the auxiliary level, right? I do not care about the physical level, the left side of these guys, only about the auxiliary level. So there's kind of a hidden symmetry on the auxiliary level, which basically says if I flip the sign on all configurations which do not have a singlet, this will not change my state up to a global phase potential. So the thing is that whatever piece I cut out of this network, I mean, it's just composing objects which are invariant under a symmetry. So this object will always stay invariant under that kind of symmetry. So of course, it's completely impossible to get an injective map after blocking, because the thing is, however I block, this thing will always live on the invariant subspace, might be the symmetric subspace or the antisymmetric subspace, depending how much I block, how many parts I block. But in either case, this map P will be always supported on a symmetric subspace. That's something I cannot change by blocking. There will always be the symmetric subspace. So it's completely impossible to invert this map to get access to the auxiliary entanglement. We cannot get access to the full singlet configuration in some sense. Well, in some sense we can, but we certainly cannot get access locally to anything which might be going on the auxiliary level. Now the thing is, these symmetries are actually quite common. All kind of topological models we know which have PEPS representations have exactly such symmetries. And they should have some strange behavior, because we know that if there's no symmetry, if this map is invertible, there's a unique ground state, which we know doesn't happen for topological models.
So I'm trying to understand what's the difference. So you're talking about the symmetry here.
Mm-hmm.
But you could have a global symmetry.
It's a virtual symmetry. It's a
right, symmetry. Right, but suppose your system has a global symmetry.
You mean a physical symmetry?
Yes.
Like SU2, SU3, whatever. Rotating the spins.
Global Z2 symmetry.
Flipping spins.
Same that you would have in the toric code. So what's the difference in terms of...
So the difference in terms of PEPS is that in one case, so if you have a physical symmetry and you put the symmetry on the physical index, you apply a Z, like a spin flip or whatever, then you can as well, you get a different, it's potentially a different representation here, but it transforms to the virtual index. This is kind of a transformation between representations. In this case, I'm saying you take the tensor, and the tensor as a whole is invariant under putting some Z here. Now, if you have both, these might should better be different and live on kind of, you know, orthogonal spaces or something like that. But one is kind of a hidden symmetry, gauge symmetry, whatever, and the other one is actually just a way to transform the physical symmetry transformation to the auxiliary level. So this is kind of much stronger because if you think in terms of transfer operators, this I mean this symmetry only appears in the transfer operator as a in the Ketembra together. This appears in Ketembra separately. So it's kind of much stronger. Okay, so if we have the symmetry, this map cannot be invertible, but the thing is it can be invertible on the invariant subspace. And it turns out that's exactly the relevant property. This map is almost injective. There is a symmetry which is related to topology. This cannot be removed, but except for that, this map allows to access the whole virtual auxiliary subspace as long as a symmetry is preserved. So once this condition is given, we can do exactly the same as before. We can invert all these maps up to this projection onto some invariant subspace of the symmetry, which could be, well, in our case, G is Z2, but the concept is general for any finite group. So we can invert this map, and we can, again, reversibly go back and forth between this very simple state, where we just have a projection, and any state we're interested in. And it turns out these states are exactly equivalent to the toric code for Z2 or the general Kitaev double models for a general finite group. So again, we have a reversible way of going from a model we might not understand to a model we do understand, like the toric code. And we can do exactly the same. We can take a Hamiltonian for this guy, which say acts on four sides, and then dress it with the inverse map, which allows us to apply it here and again annihilate the state. So we get a Hamiltonian that way. And this is again a kind of back and forth mapping. So every ground state on the left can be mapped to a ground state on the right and vice versa. So we preserve the ground state degeneracy. So the number of ground states here is equal to the number of ground states here. So we do get the topological structure we expect in that case. Okay, so the other thing to note is that if we do a smooth interpolation, remember before I said if we kind of erase this information about the dimer, where the dimers sit, we just keep the singlets. We can do this continuously by kind of continuously discarding this information. This will also give a continuous change in the Hamiltonian, which is very nice. It allows us to build a continuous interpolation along which we can study if there might be a phase transition, for instance, in that model. Okay, so how does this help us with a resonating balanced bond state? Well, the thing is we need to block, as I said before, and the thing is we need to block one star. So let's consider this state on one star. So if you block this whole thing, what is this? It's a map which takes the information on which of the six tips of the star a singlet is coming in and on which a singlet is not coming in. And from that, this linear map creates a superposition of all singlet patterns consistent with these boundary conditions.
So why did you say you have to block? I mean, you can block, but...
No, well, the thing is I want to reach this injectivity property, right? Oh. And for this, I might have to block just by parameter counting. Yeah. But also beyond parameter counting, I might have to block to actually reach this property, or I might never reach it. You know, just because a property is generic, it doesn't mean that an example you want to look at does actually fulfill it. So the thing is,
construction will really generate short range RVB.
That's short range RVB the whole time, yeah. There are generalizations to these PEPS RVB constructions, which have longer range entanglement. But in that case, I'm interested in nearest neighbor RVB.
So you're going to treat the non-orthogonality.
Sorry?
You're going to treat the non-orthogonality.
Exactly. That's exactly what's happening here. It's basically a local prescription how to orthogonalize a state. Not in a unitary way, of course, but there is a local map, a reversible map, which orthogonalizes the state and thus allows you to identify certain properties.
But basically, you're taking the resonating balanced bond state and you have an exact PEP representation, and now you're blocking that to reach the situation where you have an injective tension.
We have this G injectivity up to the symmetry.
And then you want to extract all the information from that. Okay. So exactly. You are not interpolating at this point.
Well, I'm not interpolating at this point, okay. No. I will look at that later.
So are you fully globally orthogonalizing it or just in approximately
orthogonalizing it? I'm globally orthogonalizing it, but the maps are local. I mean, they're just not unitary. I mean, it can be thought of, I guess, as some kind of continuous form of renormalization in the sense that you locally deform the state in a non-unitary way, which in some sense might correspond to RG. I mean, in 1D, it does correspond to RG. I'm not sure in here because there's this blocking and so on. But I think that's one perspective to it, slowly making things more orthogonal. So the basic observation is if you take one star, I mean, it's clear there has to be this Z2 symmetry constraint, because if you look at one star, you see that the number of ingoing singlets is always even. So there is an even parity constraint on the number of singlets. And the thing I claim is now it can be checked that all interior configurations which come from different outside boundary conditions are linearly independent, so they can be inverted. So by looking at one star, at the configuration at one star, you can conclude, I mean, mathematically again, it's not a physical measurement, that's a linear map, which allows you to conclude what the configurations of the singlets on the boundary has been. So that's kind of the intuitive picture behind. So we can think of it as just take the projection to the even parity subspace, but what it means is that we can just make all different singlet configurations on the outside of the star orthogonal. Once we have that, we can just reinstate the inside singlet configuration as well and keep it orthogonal, because that's just a simple unitary map putting the inside back and leaving it orthogonal. And the other important observation is, of course, that these stars do cover the lattice in a nice way. So all which is left out are single triangles. So it means by acting with linear maps on each of these stars, we can conclusively say where these triangles have been, which have been connecting these stars. And from this information, we can reconstruct the whole pattern up to this resonance within one star, but that's fine. Still orthogonal. So this implies as a reversible transformation to the orthogonal dimer state. And we can kick this back on the Hamiltonian and argue that this shows that there's also a Hamiltonian with a four-fold degenerate ground state for the resonating valence bond state. And the thing is, we can also do this for the whole interpolation. Where do I say that? Okay, so we get this topological ground state structure, and it applies to the interpolation. So we indeed have an interpolating path along which the Hamiltonian all the time has a four-fold degenerate ground state. And we know how the ground state looks like. We have a local patch description. Right. So
we
so
also
in,
have a form of the Hamiltonian in terms of original spin variables.
Well, the Hamiltonian is pretty complicated, I have to say. So it's just an existence proof. It's not a physical Hamiltonian in any sense that it's two or three body. So indeed, the smallest Hamiltonian that what I say on the next slide is 19 body, for which you can prove it, which requires actually more fine-tuned techniques than the ones I just described. The ones I described give very unreasonable Hamiltonians, even from the shape. So it's really more an existence proof than arguing that that's a natural Hamiltonian for that model. Although it might actually be the smallest one which you can get with these kind of properties.
Sorry, the last comment you had there?
Oh, this was just saying that, you know, if you wouldn't know anything about the dimer model, just by looking at these symmetries, you could also infer that it's locally equivalent to the periodic code.
But what if you had a double symmetry model?
Sorry?
Would you also have Z2 injected?
No, the symmetry would be a different one.
But it would be Z2? Or
would it, it would relate to Z2, but it would relate especially to the corresponding category or whatever.
So you're saying
but
that
it would be somewhat more complicated.
But it's not just Z2, it's the way Z2 is acting on the body.
Well, in this case, the Z2 refers to a group, which refers to the Kitaev double models of that group. You can generalize this invariant subspace picture also to string net models.
Well, that's nice. That's kind of but I'm asking, when you look at the action of the symmetry,
well, if the symmetry acts in this tensor product form of group representations, you know it corresponds to a Kitaev quantum double of that group,
okay, so
which means toric code for
so
Z2.
You cannot get confused with that.
You cannot get confused with that. No, that's the mapping is unique because you map it to a unique state in the end, right? You just replace whatever tensor you had by the tensor which simply projects independent states
onto
it's one state, right? So it should be a ground state of one model. And so this way you get doubles. In the other case, you need kind of more involved symmetries and more involved PEPs. But it follows the same recipe, basically, as long as you find a way to invertibly map back and forth, which relates to the kind of invariant subspace of your model.
But this projection, this P that you are acting with, this P was acting on a pre-established entangled state that you had.
Yes.
And that entangled state should be the same also. I mean, when you compare that pre-established entangled state that you started from, on which you applied P,
mm-hmm.
It also contains some information about the
The pre-established state, the easiest, I mean, the case where it's kind of, where you get the toric code easily should just be bipartite and maximally entangled states. So indeed, the thing with the triangles, if you want to do this, what I say in this note, it's more tricky. You have to kind of take this thing and re-slice it in a different way where you
what
get
I'm
bipartite ones.
Is it just
this is a bit cheating.
Right, so you have cheating. Action of Z2 acting there. But do you have to compare the action when... So you have two phases, right? You
mm-hmm.
you apply your blocking, you end up with two injected P's
mm-hmm.
that you can undo,
and then you are left with this state that you have at the beginning. Mm-hmm. You want the two phases to start with the same initial final state.
So what I can say, if your P is a projector onto an invariant space, the entangled state should be the bipartite entangled state, kind of the standard peps I showed in the beginning. This form is these triangles, that's different. The thing is, just by knowing that this map can be inverted on this even parity subspace, and knowing that the dimer model is like is a Z2 system in the Tory code phase, is good enough, because this way you can relate to the Tory code.
Okay, yeah.
But if you want to relate to the Tory code kind of directly by looking at the symmetry, you want bipartite entanglement.
Okay.
Because this is, there can be good and bad entanglement. I can tell you later. There are examples where it doesn't work because for examples where we know they're not Z2 spin liquids, different lattices, mm-hmm. because the entangled state which remains is kind of the wrong form. So the form matters, but this triangle is good.
Okay.
How much time do we have left?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. So that's. That's kind of the end of the analytical part. I will show some numerical results in the next slides. Okay, so what this shows is that the RVB state is a ground state of some local so-called parent Hamiltonian with a topologically general ground space structure. So on the Torus, that would be fourfold, but it would generally relate to the Tory code structure. So the main tool was to see that there's a symmetry in the underlying tensors, and kind of there are no more symmetries. We need to fully identify all symmetries. There's one invariant subspace, and except for that, we can invert the thing. And this way, we can get an invertible mapping to something like the Tory code or some other understood model. And by kind of continuously removing this orthogonality information of the dimers, we can create a smooth interpolation. And the Hamiltonian we get is actually smooth, because it's only locally dressed with this deformation. So a caveat that this construction does tell us there are four ground states. It does not tell us there's a gap above these four ground states. So in principle, it could be a gapless model. This requires extra inspection. In principle, that's checkable with an effort which shouldn't scale with the system size. But I guess we have to wait for bigger computers until we can actually check it. It could be that it's not, but I'm pretty sure it is checkable if it's true.
It might be exponentially hard.
In what?
In the bond dimension.
But that's 3. Exponential of 3 is what, 27?
No, sorry. In 2D, we don't have a proof on the injectivity length. We don't know what the injectivity.
No, but I don't care. No, let's discuss it later. But there's okay. Anyway, there's a criterion which can be checked. If it's satisfied, it can be checked at the finite blocking length. It might be that there's a gap, but this criterion fails to detect it, which I don't believe happens. Okay, so since we don't know there's a spectral gap, we have to put in some extra care. Okay, but. Indeed, as I said earlier, so the smallest Hamiltonian we can actually get by kind of low-level techniques acts on 2 stars, which is fairly big, but in some sense it's a very simple Hamiltonian because it just projects onto the subspace which is occupied by all possible dimer configurations on that star. So it's a frustration.
Sorry, what are you trying to do now? What is this comment about?
The comment is just about the size of... I made a comment about this here, but no. This is just saying that the smallest Hamiltonian is acting on this system, just to say it.
To have what?
I should probably...
Hamiltonian sets that work.
Such that you have a fourfold degenerate ground space.
That's a frustration-free Hamiltonian.
So the whole construction I discussed was taking one Hamiltonian and kind of via this invertible maps, kicking it back to the other model.
I thought you had a wave function.
Yes.
And then you inverted this map.
Yes, and I found a Hamiltonian for that wave function, which had 4 ground states, provably, like 0 energy ground states, and then something above. And the smallest possible Hamiltonian, which this construction would yield, would act on 2 overlapping stars like that. So it's not a two-body Hamiltonian. Okay, so the questions which are still interesting is, which I didn't answer, is this actually a spin liquid? So do all correlations decay exponentially, or is there some kind of long-range order? The other question, because we can't check the gap, we should look more closely if the system is actually topologically ordered, or if there's maybe a phase transition between that and the dimer model.
Wait, this Hamiltonian, is it, if it's on 2 stars, can we work with that numerically at all? Play with that Hamiltonian?
I don't know, but we know the ground state.
It's a mess.
Well, it's 2 to the 9e.
Yes. It's admittedly a mess.
But,
yes.
But your claim is that this is a Hamiltonian for which your wave function is the unique ground state.
Fourfold.
Yeah.
Yes.
The original RVB.
Yes. The thing is, this wasn't known before. I mean, you know, people have things like, you know, once you're in the subspace, which only consists of valid nearest neighbor singlets, then they get the Hamiltonian on one star, which gets the phases right. But there was no way to ensure that you're in the right subspace. So it seems big, but, you know, it wasn't known before at all that there's any Hamiltonian of that kind. Okay, so how can one numerically study these states? So what we did is we studied these states on very long cylinders. So the idea is we take this Kagome lattice, which is, well, here just painted a dual lattice of a hexagonal lattice, and take square blocks because squares are just easier. So we have three spins per elementary cell, so it's still half integer spin, which is good. And if we want to compute any kind of expectation values, what we have to do is we have to take this 2D tensor network, we have to put these operators in between, and we have to put the adjoint thing on top, right? So it's psi op psi. And if you look at that from the top and you use this kind of notation for transfer operators, which is just a cat and a bra together, you get this kind of 2D grid of tensors. And if you contract this thing for infinity and with kind of periodic boundary conditions, you get the correlation between, say, an operator sitting here and an operator sitting somewhere here. And the point is, all these correlations are mediated by this transfer operator of one ring. So the thing is that it doesn't matter what operators we look at. We could look at any operator. Any kind of correlation function will have a behavior which is given by the spectral properties of this transfer operator. So looking at this, at the spectral properties of this transfer operator will tell us everything about any kind of correlation. We don't have to explicitly kind of guess what might be the correlations which might be there or not and check those. So the thing is, this transfer operator can be exactly diagonalized. So there are different methods actually to compute the spectrum. One can use approximate methods or exact methods. We prefer exact methods because we can still go to about 10 sites where each site contains three spins and we get machine precision data, which allows very good extrapolations. So that's the exact diagonalization for the gap of the transfer operator. You can the diameter of the thing. You can see it converges extremely quickly. That's some convergence analysis in 1 over n. So here's the RVB point. This is the interpolation to the toric code, which of course has a maximal gap in the transfer operator because it has correlation length 0. And then the correlations get kind of longer as we go to the RVB point. But we see they clearly stay finite. There's no sign of divergence or anything. So there's no kind of long range order in that state really from this data. So this really very strongly shows that this is a spin liquid indeed. There's no kind of long range order in that system. And also that there's no phase transition between the toric code or the Diamond model and this model. Everything seems to be smoothly. There's certainly no phase transition which can be detected in any kind of correlation function.
I'm sorry, I don't understand what it means that for the toric code, this ratio of lambda 2 over lambda 1 goes to 0. What does it mean?
Well, I have to say I'm kind of omitting something there. Actually, a degeneracy in the largest eigenvalue corresponds to the topological order. But if you forget about that, the thing below is a topologically degenerate thing.
So who is lambda 1 to lambda 2?
Lambda 2 is the second largest eigenvalue.
Okay.
Not counting degeneracies, which gives you the correlation length. Right? The correlations decay as this to the distance. So correlation length is 0 in the toric code, right?
Okay.
All correlations are completely gone after one side.
Okay. But you could still have topological non-trivial excitations that have that, a power law decay.
No, that's actually very interesting. I will show you, if I still have a minute or two, three.
Yeah.
I can show that actually these guys, that's kind of a bit sloppy here. These guys actually do correspond to topological non-trivial excitations and their correlation. The correlations are even much shorter if you look at trivial ones. So for that, it's kind of important to really look at all four ground states. Actually, this transfer operator was kind of just taking the tensors as we had them locally and building the transfer operator. That's neglecting half of the information. The thing is there are four ground states or two ground states, depends how you count it, on a cylinder. So the thing is we can put left and right boundary conditions on that thing, which depending on the parity with respect to the Z symmetry of the boundary will give us different ground states. But we can also put a string of these Zs when we close a boundary because that's such a symmetry. The string is not detectable locally. It could be anywhere in the system. So it's kind of no local information, but it does change the topological information. It's kind of a Vison line. You change the sign of all singlets crossing this link. Right? So that's a Vison line, and the other one is fixing the parity of singlets at the boundary. Okay, let's skip that. That's just saying that from this parametrization of this ground state manifold, we can actually compute lots of things, including, for instance, one could use these to find minimally entangled states and determine things like grading statistics, like what Lucas explained in his talk. But anyway, so the thing is that this transfer operator, because there are four ground states potentially, So the thing is that this guy has, there are two of these, and these have a symmetry additionally, which means these guys decay into two blocks, the even and the odd number of singlets at the edge, or even or odd z to the n symmetry block. So there are four blocks in the cat layer and four blocks in the bra layer, which means that transfer operator has 16 blocks. So there are four kind of diagonal blocks corresponding to correlations within one ground state. And there are four, there the other 10 blocks corresponding to kind of overlap elements of different ground states, if you wish. And now if you look at these guys, so that's the largest eigenvalue of the diagonal blocks. So just the norm of these the states. I think this is cheating. I just drew a straight line here. But in fact, there's an exponentially small splitting in the system size between these guys, which you can't really resolve for 10 sites. So these guys have a vanishing splitting, which is important because the norm should be equal in the thermodynamic limit. Otherwise, some of the states wouldn't be stable. The off-diagonal eigenvalues correspond to overlap elements or to correlation functions, which kind of, you know, create one excitation, half an excitation here and the other half here. So it's actually not a correlation of a local operator. And then if you look at the second largest eigenvalue of the diagonal block, right, psi a, operator here, operator there, psi a, this will tell you how correlation functions of local operators here and here decay. And that's indeed much smaller. So that kind of, I guess, answers your question that indeed this thing I showed you earlier indeed even bounds the decay of string operators, which create a pair of spinons or vsons here and here. And this is actually also shows you that's actually very interesting. From the spectral properties, one can also infer that the system is topologically ordered, because what this tells us is that, you know, if I want to know the overlap of two of these guys, the normalized overlap, this scales like the off-diagonal element normalized by the diagonal elements to the n. So indeed, if these guys are suppressed, and we see they are suppressed, then this goes to zero. So these states are indeed orthogonal, and they have the same length. So it's not that one of them or two of them vanish in the thermodynamic limit. And this might sound trivial, but that's an important thing to have topological order. So for instance, if you take a toric code with some magnetic field, with some string tension, which you can map to the Ising model, so we know there's a phase transition here. We see we have four ground states here. These are the diagonal ones. And two stay up here, but the other two go down, which means that the norm of the thermodynamic limit goes to zero. So these states are actually not actual ground states. They depend on the fine tuning of the system. And on the other hand, two off-diagonal elements come up here. So it turns out that for the other two states, these states are actually not two states in the thermodynamic limit. They're only one state because they become equal. So although this model also has kind of four ground states from the construction, it turns out they're actually not four ground states. There's actually only one ground state, and it's not topological anymore. So by kind of studying these spectral properties of the transfer operator, you can infer or substantiate a claim that the system is topologically ordered. And it's actually relevant to check these things, because it could be that you have all these relevant symmetries. You can construct this Hamiltonian, like in this case here, but it turns out it's actually not topologically ordered. So I have some entanglement spectra, but I guess it's too late, so I should probably stop if anyone wants to have a look at the entanglement spectra.
Right, it's,
okay, I'll stop.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Questions?
Can I see the panel
spectrum? Oh, sure. Do you have a question? So that's the entanglement spectrum okay, that's a resonating valence bond state. That's the, actually not toric code, but dimer state.
This is for some cylinder with some width?
That's a cylinder with some width, I guess. It says 8, right?
8.
In infinite cylinder with 8. And so that's starting from the dimer model and then slowly kind of discarding the information where the dimers are until we get to the RVB point. That's half integer, that's integer excitations. The funny thing is that it seems to become gapless pretty much exactly at the RVB point. I'm not sure if that's coincidence or if there's a good reason that, you know, it might be protected by some symmetry. Could be, I don't know. If anyone has a good idea why it should become gapless there.
When you say it becomes gapless, what becomes gapless?
The entanglement spectrum. Well, that's the log of the entanglement spectrum, right? That's
so
the spectrum of the corresponding Hamiltonian.
You're saying it looks like a CFT?
I don't know. If it looks like a CFT, I didn't check if it looks like a CFT, but it certainly becomes gapless. I think it's basic. It's probably very close to free fermions.
So I'm saying no.
I don't know.
I think
it's not obvious. It's the symmetry. The RVB point may not have the symmetry. Is not. I mean, the symmetry protect is like a gapless state. It's not there in the RVB point. Mm-hmm. So it's gapless symmetry for another reason.
No, it might be gapless. The question is it protected by a simple symmetry or it's a super fine-tuning thing?
Yeah,
that's what I'm not sure about.
Fine, yeah.
I mean, it might be that just a very simple symmetry protects that, or it's just fine-tuning. And like the toric code is, I guess, fine-tuning if it's gapless. Whereas this might be less fine-tuning.
So by the diagram model, you mean the quantum diagram model of some of us?
So basically, I'm tensoring the singlets in the RVB with an arrow description. With this arrow description. So I put an extra qubit everywhere, which kind of encodes this arrow.
I understand that. So when you say dimer, you don't make some fixed dimer in red, you mean the liquid of dimer.
Yes, the resonating dimer or whatever. I use it to distinguish orthogonal from non-orthogonal, roughly.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that's standard, but I had to choose some convention. So this is kind of a chemical potential, and here it's roughly a Hopping Hamiltonian. It's kind of a 2J model. It's a spinful fermion or a vacuum. No, not fermion, but a spinful particle or a vacuum, and it's mostly Hopping. What describes this particle.
Is there some notion that the entanglement Hamiltonian remains in the same phase if your original state remains in the same phase?
I don't know. I should check. I guess. I don't know. You shouldn't ask me. I mean, I'm not an expert.
Because we have seen that this is all in the same phase as toric code, and we have seen that toric code is indeed entanglement Hamiltonian for the toric code.
Well,
it's actually the Ising.
Well, this Hamiltonian is actually toric code up to a local unitary.
And
it's
therefore, this should be the CFT. So this should be the CFT of the Ising then.
Aha. Ising with field.
Well, that depends on state phase. This is not a chiral state, so you could have edge phase transitions.
Well, I don't know. That's my question. Is there a notion that indeed this is like preserved? Is there some. That if your state is in the same phase, that also the entanglement Hamiltonian is kind of.
Yeah, so it could be one of a set of different things. It's not unique, I think. You could have edge phase transitions just of the entanglement spectrum, which is consistent with the bulk.
Would that be observable?
Yeah.
Can you change it? Just change
the
edge combination.
Because you can have phase transitions in the system is the same.
Of course, this perturbation is very different from the perturbation we saw in Lucas talk where you put a magnetic field on the toric code. I think that's kind of orthogonal to that perturbation. There's nothing which would correspond to a magnetic field, I think. Because the field would kind of freeze the dimers, basically, if you translate it back from the toric code.
But the point of putting a field there was just put any perturbation that turns this flat spectrum into something that is not.
The thing is, it's not flat for the dimer model. Because, I mean, you cut through the dimers, so you actually get a chemical potential. So it's the same thing as the toric code, but you cut it kind of differently. You induce local entanglement, you cut it, so you get a chemical potential.
But can you terminate the edge in different ways so that they will correspond to different bonds?
Oh, you say if you cut in different ways, or?
Yeah.
I guess you can.
Yeah,
we didn't do that, but I mean, it can definitely be done.
The same thing with the toric code. How did you cut this? What is the cut? What's the cylinder cut you put on the lattice?
X zero, Y zero, would have to check. Didn't do the calculations myself for this. So
last question, Vasco.
See, in the simpler case of square lattice, there is this strange algebraic correlation of bond.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything similar here and will it have any consequences?
No, that's correlations decay exponentially here.
Spin correlation. Uh-huh. But if you take square lattice on dimer or RVD, dimer at dark A point, it's supposed to be dimer correlation which vanishes.
Yes.
Same thing happens to chalk A lattice. Calculate force spin correlation. Numerically, you have shown that even though spin correlation decays exponentially,
For square lattice,
the singlet-singlet correlation has algebraic part.
So the thing here is that we see that the transfer operator has a gap, which really means that any correlation function. I mean, I think that's one great thing here, that you know, usually you have to figure out which correlation function do I want to check. You check it, it decays exponentially. It doesn't tell you that there's no other ones. But the transfer operator tells you that really any kind of correlation function decays exponentially because it mediates anything which happens here with what happens here.
So is this construction possible or easy for square lattice?
You can do it for the square lattice, but there you will not get the spectral problem. It's the same construction, basically. It works for any lattice, nearest neighbor RVB, certainly.
Okay.
But the transfer operator doesn't have a gap. It actually has a very high degeneracy in that case, which relates to the fact that, you know, here we have a Z2 conserved quantity, and for the square lattice, you have a Z conserved quantity. Right? So it's
So when you say the entanglement Hamiltonian of bosonic helium, is a spin a half bosonic helium?
Well, bosonic just, I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's 1D. It could be fermionic or bosonic. But
it's spin a half.
The non-nearest, yes. I mean, you could also say fermionic. The thing is just that the non-nearest neighbor terms get a Jordan weakness thing if you write it fermionic, but not if you write it bosonic. So it's more likely bosonic. At least it looks simpler when you write it as a bosonic Hamiltonian.
And just moving on which size is it moving? The size associated with what?
Well, it's kind of the auxiliary entanglement, the bonds, if you wish. Well, the idea is that, you know, you cut somewhere, there's either an outgoing singlet or there's no outgoing singlet. No outgoing singlet is like vacuum, and the outgoing singlet has a spin because you cut it.
Okay.
But it's just basically just arguing from the symmetry. Looking at the symmetries, we know there's a conserved Z2 thing, so you can only, you cannot change the parity of that thing. And there's a symmetry coming from SU2, which is 1/2 plus 0, which kind of naturally corresponds to having a vacuum or a spinful particle.
Why do you conserve the number of bosons?
Well, there's no fundamental reason. That's why I would like fermionic more, but...
No, why do you conserve, why should the number, why can't you have a B-dagger term?
Well, there's no constraint of that kind, actually, from the symmetries. There can be a term like that, also for fermions.
Okay, well, then it's not a...
Okay, we can remove it, the bosonic or fermionic.
It's not a TJ model.
I think what I want to say, it has a structure of a TJ model, in the sense that there's a vacuum and then a spinful object which has an SU2 symmetry in the Hamiltonian. And you cannot change the parity. So there's some kind of...
Local.
I'm not saying you get a fermionic model. It's kind of... It has a structure of a TJ model.
But there's no global U1 corresponding to chemical potential.
No, there's no particle conversion. No.
Yeah, right. Okay.
At least there's no need, but there should be one.
Yeah, we've got a TJ model.
Okay. I apologize in that case.
Okay, let's move on.